Engineers Simon Hawkes and Anthony Demanti, or Hawkes and AD to their mates, are on a journey down the river of water engineering. In this podcast series, Hawkes and AD share their inspiring conversations with a cross-section of people from the water industry and beyond. The conversations aim to motivate students and professionals alike to contribute to the growth of the engineering profession. So, without further ado, it's over to you, lads.
Hello, everyone, and thanks for joining us on another inspiring episode of The Good Drop with Hawkes and AD, a water industry-flavoured podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Anthony Demanti, and thanks for joining me again on episode 29. And with me in the studio booth once more is Mr. Simon Hawkes. Great to see you again, Simon. And how are you doing today, my friend?
Not very well, thanks, AD. Another wonderful Thursday in the city. Ready for another episode of The Good Drop.
Yeah, it has been a little bit of a while since our last one, but yeah, good things come to those who wait, don't you say?
Yes, a little bit of scheduling and coordination issues, but you just got to make do and move on, keep going.
That's it. All right, well, today's guest, I have to say, is a true inspiration. This man has racked up over 5 decades of experience, more than both of us combined. It's just amazing, really. I know I'll be turning the big 5-0 in the next few days, and that just puts it into perspective that our guest has been working in the industry more than I've been alive, and that's just an incredible feat, really. His longevity and passion for sharing his knowledge back to the water industry is impressive, and I have to ask you this, Simon, do you think you'll make it to 50 years of experience?
So I would be about the same age, I think, so we'll see. If I ever finish paying off the mortgage, maybe I'll still be working.
I don't think I'll be making it to 50 years experience, but you never know. You never know. So I'm going to introduce our guest. And our guest today is Rob Welke, who is the Managing Director of Water Pumping Institute, which is an international body committed to education in sustainable pumping for water pipeline systems. As I touched on, Rob is an absolute stalwart of the water industry who has over 56 years experience in pumping and hydraulics. He has a particular passion for energy efficiency and sustainability, and his training program is the conduit for doing this. With no signs of slowing down, Rob has just recently returned from conducting his training course in Auckland, New Zealand. So Rob, Simon and I can't wait to hear about your amazing story and journey, and maybe learn about some of your secrets that power your passion and longevity. Thank you for joining us on the Good Drop podcast. Welcome.
Thanks, Anthony and Simon. Pleasure to be here. We've had some conversations before and I've been looking forward to this moment. So let's get underway.
Excellent. So tell us about your recent trip to New Zealand. What did you get up to over there? How long were you there for?
Well, our primary purpose really was to run our training courses over there. We ran 3 training courses, 2 in Christchurch and 1 in Auckland. As normal when we run training courses, this is we, as in Sandy, my wife, who's my business partner, and myself, we also take time out to have a look around and a bit of R&R. So it was a combination, training and having a look around, and no better place to do that in New Zealand, I can tell you.
It's fantastic. You got the best of both worlds, work and pleasure. Well,
absolutely. It's a really good balance, you know. They say, you know, enjoy what you're doing and you never work a day in your life. Well, yeah. That's exactly how it is with us, you know. I don't regard this as work at all. It's just a full-on pleasure every day.
That's really fantastic. So where did you do your seminars? Do you do them for a day or do they go longer? Or and where do you have the pleasure of stopping in across the ditch?
Okay, so first of all, they're all 2-day, and I have different streams. I have a stream traditionally for the irrigation industry, and we've recently branched out and created a stream for the water and wastewater industry, and that's the one that Anthony has just recently attended in Brisbane, and in New Zealand we ran 1 irrigation stream and 2 water and wastewater streams, 1 in Christchurch and 1 in Auckland. While we're there, we flew into Christchurch. We actually took a detour by car down to Queenstown. Oh, it is just sensational. Queenstown, puts goose pimples on me just thinking about it. It's a fabulous place. So we were down there to see the Wings Over Wanaka, the World War II fighter aircraft display. Every 2 years they have one at a town called Wanaka. It's about 100 k's north of Queenstown. And in between the other courses, we had a look around mostly the North Island. So we've practically travelled from the tip of the South Island to the tip of the North Island and did three training courses en route.
That's excellent. And look, there's no side hustle going on here, but I totally enjoyed Rob's course, Simon, and definitely asked a lot of tricky questions, which Rob negotiated pretty well. And I'm sure everything was smooth sailing after he had me in his class.
I remember it really well, Anthony, and I did say to you, I expect you to challenge me at every opportunity, and you did. And well, how did I fare?
You passed.
Thank you. Well. I think you've been the most critical of any person in the course, and I do believe I have to stand
critical in a good way. Though. Come on.
Yes. Yeah. No. That's what I meant. That's what I meant. I have to be able to stand the scrutiny of the industry, because many out there doing stuff can't and won't, and I think, well, you know, I really set an example in that way. Integrity is foremost, I think, for what I do.
Before we get back to the original story or the starting point, so running your training courses, I presume, is a continuous craft. You know, it's never something that's perfect. I'd imagine you're always probably your own harshest critic in trying to deliver a perfect seminar. But how do you gauge where you're at compared to other similar courses? Have you done any out of interest just to see where you stand?
I've done a couple. One of the benchmark courses is one put on by one of the major American pump companies. And I say pump companies because the water industry is dominated by pump companies. They traditionally have formed training courses for the industry, and it's very pump centric, and it's really not a lot to do with the pipelines. And that's where we differ, hugely differ. And I thought, yeah, you know, every training course that I've seen is good value, but it's not what we need to know. They're about selling pumps. I'm about educating about pipelines and hydraulics and the importance of sustainability.
The marriage of the two.
Yes, the marriage of the two. So I fill a gap. You know, there's so much information out there on pumps. There's so much on the delivery side of the water, so, you know, especially in the irrigation industry. There's a big void in the middle, and I believe this fills that void.
Yeah, right. The irrigation industry is something with, at least in the water utility space where Anthony and I probably tend to operate for the most part, it seems quite removed from us. The opportunity to work in irrigation is limited in my experience, unless you're kind of working for, say, a Murray-Darling Basin Authority. So interesting to hear that you work in that area.
Well, I sort of work in that area. You know, the irrigation industry is focused very much on water. And they introduced their own pump training courses, which really are no different from what the pump industry offer. So there's still that gap in the middle. And I've spent since 2010 trying to fill that gap. And in that time, I've run 115 training courses.
Good average.
And taught over 900 people. The courses that I've taught have evolved, you know. So this training course wasn't an overnight decision. It started off with a small area of expertise, and that was flow meters, because I had an enormous amount of flow meter expertise that I brought from SA Water back in my SA Water days from 1968 to 1992, where I was responsible for 2,500 flow meters for the water diversions area. And I did a lot of research and development on flow meters because we were finding a lot of inaccuracies in them. And that passion went through to creating a training course for flow meters. And I built on that. And now, you know, I mean, my focus has changed from flow meters to pipelines, because in the meantime, I had a lot of experience, hands-on experience with pipeline systems that continually changed, number one, built on my expertise, but changed the focus that I had to the point now I live inside of a pipeline, like all the time, you know, essentially.
Rob, tell us about that journey. You know, you mentioned SA Water was a big part of your early career. I'd love you to tell your story to our listeners because it is really interesting and how you got into it.
Well, how I got into it, that's fascinating itself. I started out doing a Bachelor of Technology in Mechanical Engineering degree. And in my second year, the University SA, Uni SA, it was called the Institute of Technology back in those days. In its wisdom, prior to Australia's conversion to matrication, changed the textbooks in every single year in the university degree from imperial to metric. And that happened in my second year. And that was extremely disruptive. You know, all the conventions, you know, how long is a foot? You know, you have these concepts of how big some things are. And then you change the units and you, like, you have the rug pulled from out of, from under you. So I collapsed in that year, not literally, but, you know, so I changed direction. And the first
thing I did. What year was that, Rob?
That was
66?
That was 67.
67.
Yeah. So I went along to, this is January in 1968, I went along to a Commonwealth Employment Service office in Prospect in South Australia, and I said I would like to do a fitting and turning apprenticeship. So he said, oh, you had a look at my you know, education. He said, yeah, you've done, you know, a couple of years of uni degree. I think we should be able to get you in pretty soon somewhere. And he rang me up the following day and said, you can start with engineering water supply department next Monday.
Wow.
Well, that's how quick I got in. Now, everybody else was applying to get into apprenticeship the previous year, September, and I got in 3 days. Like,
yeah, you don't get that at Centrelink nowadays. You don't chop it in. For those probably not quite old enough, that's what Centrelink used to be called, CES.
It did. And so, Anthony, to answer your question, you know, did I look to work in the water industry? No, I didn't. I had this opportunity given to me on a platter, and I just ran with it. Yeah. It was, you know, it's like the universe was having a substantial effect on my life, and just the whole thing went from strength to strength, and I was presented with opportunity after opportunity, and I loved every minute of it. It was just an amazing experience. There were a couple of areas, you know, as an apprentice, it wasn't particularly inspiring. I was, you know, I was an adult. I started when I was 20 years old, and I was kicking around with 15 and 16 year olds and being treated the same as, you know. I didn't enjoy those 3 years too much, but I did take as much as I could away with me. The very informative years, the very basics of mechanical engineering start, you know, with the lathe, the milling machine, the grinder, you know, the forge, heat treatment, you know, all those sort of things. At the end of that, I did a 3-year apprenticeship, which is a short term. The head office came to me and said, look, we'd like you to come up to a meeting next week, which I did, and they said, we'd like you to stay on. Here's the choice of two jobs that we're offering you. One is in the drafting office of the sewage treatment or the sewage branch, and the other one was as an assistant to the pumping engineer. And I thought, oh, that's a no-brainer. I'll go with a pumping engineer. And once again, you know, I mean, I got to test pumps and climb all over pipeline systems all over South Australia. And South Australia being the dry state of the driest continent in the world, we are disproportionately or over proportionately reliant on pumping infrastructure to get Adelaide its water supply. 90% of Adelaide's water is pumped from the River Murray in a dry year. So, you know, I was right there and amongst it all and having a ball, monitoring the efficiency of these pumping systems and pipeline systems. Yeah, I know, it was just amazing.
Did you think you were always going to go down that path? Like, where did you think you were going to end up? Do you have any other different career path?
Okay, let me go back some years when I was on the farm as a kid. This was a mixed farm, and even as a 6 or 7 year old, I was tinkering around in the workshop. And we had quite a significant workshop. And this was, mind you, in an environment where my father would buy equipment, sometimes brand new, and it wouldn't work as planned. And so he would modify this brand new equipment to make it do the job that it was designed to do. So right from a very young age, I come to realize that, hey, not everybody out there knows what they're doing, but they're making a quid. You know, that's one of the first things I learned, is that people that sell product are there to make a living, and you can't deny them that. But the product is not necessarily fit for purpose. So here I am as a young kid, you know, working almost spare time in the workshop, making things, hammering nails into wood, shaping up things. And by the time I was 13, I was welding and grinding and cutting. And one of the things that I did when I was 16 years old, I built this. That's a model dragster, okay?
And you've still got it.
I've still got it. It looks great. I've still got it. I built that in 1964, okay? So if you hop on my website, on the front page, you go about three quarters of the way down, there's a video of how it's constructed.
Just trying to describe it, listeners. It's a foot long. Can I say it's a foot? It's a foot long.
It's 60 centimetres. It's 60 centimetres long.
Oh, 60 centimetres. Bigger than it looks.
Yeah. It's a bit of a way back in the lounge there because I can't get any closer. I dare not knock it over because it's fragile. You know, I've built a box to keep it in. But, you know, I think that's the epitome of me, because it was built with passion, and the road to the final product was long and arduous and enjoyable the whole way. I think that describes it down to a T. You know, that's just such an incredible part of my life. I mean, we all come from nothing, and we're formed from life's experiences, and to some degree we have power over that, but mostly we don't. You know, especially in our younger years, we're the product of our parents' environment. And my father, fortunately, I suppose, guided my two brothers and I into this environment. And he said, Robert, don't ever be a farmer. That's a mug's game. And I thought, okay. Well, okay, so what should I be? Well, either be a surveyor or an engineer. And I thought, okay. So in time, I kind of worked out what both of those wanted, were involving, and I decided I wasn't going to be a surveyor because that meant camping out, and I wasn't really a camper. I like my creature comforts, I think. Always have. Yeah. So that's the background.
Yeah,
I think that answered your question.
Yeah, I loved your little journey, you know. I couldn't remember if you wanted to be a doctor or a dentist, but yeah, Dad gave you some wisdom into choosing a path in engineering.
Yeah.
So let me do some mental sums. It's a bit over 30 years, or was it 68 to 92, did you mention?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, what, 34, was that? Yeah, 34 years, right? Gosh,
92. 68, 88. It's
42
years ago.
Is it?
Yeah, so 24 years experience in SA Water, though. Yes.
92, it's 34 years ago, sorry. 92 to 22 is 30 years. And we're 24,
no,
so it's
no. Tom
years.
Is talking about the duration.
Yeah. I was. I'm talking. Yeah,
the duration.
That's
okay. So 24 years.
Yeah.
So at SA Water.
So 24 years in SA Water.
Yeah, which, I pipped for 25. I pipped the 25. So it was February 68 to February 93, because I got a 25 year badge. I know. So it was actually February 93. I spent the last three or four months on long surface leave.
So what prompted you to leave SA Water? You would have known everything about everything at SA Water.
You know what? The times that I was in SA Water, it was the most insane place to work in as much as there was always so much money. money was thrown around like and spent like drunken sailors in the 70s and 80s by government departments. And then, you know, late 80s, early 90s, the clamps were on. And so when I joined, there were 10,000 people in that organization. When I left, there were 2,500. Yeah. So we were under pressure. A lot of people were under pressure to take a package. Mm. And so I did. Yeah.
Lots of knowledge would have left the industry.
Absolutely. And it was just because we had such a high proportion of infrastructure per capita in South Australia, we had such a really good engineering team in that. It's now called SA Water. That's all gone out to, the professional consultants. What's left is really a shell of what was there. With very little expertise, they're really administrators.
You know, when you think about the way a project would have been delivered in the 80s or 90s or even before, everything was done by the water agency, such as, you know, the SA Water or Sydney Water or whomever it may be. There was no procurement per se in going out to market and saying, can you build this brick room and can you supply these pumps? Sure, I mean, I guess there's the elements of, you know, equipment supply, but generally the whole fabric, well, putting it all together, the actual construction that we have, I guess, contractors for nowadays would have been done in-house, which is just amazing, I think.
Yeah, I think as an example, I was a senior tech officer for most of that period in SA Water, and I was kind of pulled aside to do a lot of project work. And as an example, in that particular era, about the late 80s, there was a bit of a scare with the world's oil suppliers. And these are all engineered things by the oil companies. But the bottom line was that all the government departments decided that they should reduce their fuel consumption, total consumption, by 10%. So in truly government department style, we formed a committee, and the committee was there responsible for reducing the engineering water supply department's fuel consumption by 10%. So there was about eight engineers. They're all branch heads, and myself, I was the legs. So the majority of fuel was from driving vehicles. So I finished up running tests with, you know, the present vehicle, which was, you know, a 1988 Holden, and I put a special fuel metering device, which every vehicle's got now, but back in those times it was pretty rare. And I found myself up a country road doing all sorts of tests with a sun visor and without a sun visor, and driving with the windows down and driving with the windows up, you know, and all these sort of things to try And this one, driving, I removed the fan, the engine cooling fan, because once you're moving, a motor vehicle doesn't require an engine cooling fan. It's just there for when the vehicle's stationary. And I had a ball. It was about 2 months' work. And at the end, I put together a report and said, yep, we can save 10%. We'll just do these things, you know. So I think my whole life, every component of it, was about improving the efficiency of way we do things, you know, challenging the way we do things. So that was just one example. And this report, if you have a look at my website, you'll see reference to the report. And I've still got a copy of that report here. All those major reports I wrote in SA Water, I've still got copies of those.
So Rob, this passion for energy efficiency, did you always sort of have it? Where is it coming from?
I think in more recent years, I've described my background. My background has kind of groomed me into being what I am. But when I see what goes on in the industry, particularly the water industry, I think largely energy efficiency, how would I put it? It's not really taken that seriously. The majority of what we are taught and what we're exposed to is from the major pump companies. Their major role is to sell product and make a profit. Along the lines, of course, they do claim that they can have, you know, superior pump efficiencies, and that's all fine. It really doesn't make too much difference in the end, because The efficiency of our pumping systems has really very little to do with the efficiency of the pump. And so few people realize that. I'm kind of driven to get this message out to as many people as I can before I pass on to the next world. And that's the driver. That's what gets me out of bed in the morning. And someone says, when are you retiring? And I said, oh, I don't know, I might do that at the end of the year. And as the end of the year approaches, I said, there's no way I can stop doing this, you know, because there's still so much misunderstanding and misinformation out there.
What do you find the biggest aspect of misunderstanding?
That very few appreciate the importance of pipeline hydraulics in the assessment of pumping system efficiency. There's still just that narrow focus on the pump efficiency. I don't expect that'll go away soon, but I firmly believe that even though I'm not going to get around to everybody in the world before I go, what I teach will become mainstream in time. You know, I firmly believe that. Just how it happens, I don't know, but yeah.
So you're referring to the hydraulic efficiency in the pipeline more so?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Every, I guess, element of reduction of friction certainly translates to a cost saving in that space.
Yes, and there's two aspects to that. One is the optimization process in achieving that. Because you can't over-design. Well, you can over-design, but it's a matter of balancing the cost versus the returns. But the other big factor is taking into account the depreciation of the pipeline performance in time. And that's an area where I've had considerable expertise and exposure, particularly in SA Water. And since then, in the private sector, with recycled water. So that, you know, the depreciation of pipeline performance is a pretty major part of the training course that we run. And I think that opens people's eyes more than anything. I don't know, Anthony, having seen it, might wish to comment on that.
I don't generally work in water. I work traditionally more in the wastewater side. But, yeah, no, look, especially long pipeline, especially large flow pipelines where water is more common than wastewater, definitely it's a big consideration. I learned a lot from the course about how, biofilm buildup inside these pipelines can have a big impact. And correct me if I'm wrong, Rob, but velocity is not your answer to fixing biofilm issues.
No.
That was one of the big things.
Yeah, it's one of the first guidelines that we look at, but then it's often totally overridden by the biofilm buildup or other matter buildup in the pipeline. And it's a matter of considering both, and the course looks at that in detail. Of course, ultimately, you've got to go out and determine what the systems that you might be in charge of, what is the performance of your system, you know? So the other thing we teach is how to measure the efficiency of pipelines. Everybody knows how to measure a pump efficiency. That's of little value to us. How to measure pipeline efficiency is hugely an advantage. Yeah. So that becomes your datum. Yeah.
Yeah. I was just thinking, trying to think on the spot of how you might set up a baseline and then the improved and how to, you know, do that in practice in the field with a pipeline. So you're getting into elements of, you know, the benefits of pipeline pigging and things like that. Exploring those things.
Yes. Yeah. And that comes into it. And not just, you know, with water, but wastewater, seawater. There's a lot of pigging takes place in all the pipeline industries, especially the petroleum industry, that they have paraffins that deposit on their pipes. And they have a real issue. And it's probably about akin to the seawater industry, where the value, the performance of the pipeline will halve inside of a year. If left unattended.
Wow, half in a year is a significant...
Half of the efficient, like it will go down to 50% efficiency within 1 year if it's not attended to.
Rob, just want to bring back that moment in your life when you decided to open up or found Water Pumping Institute.
Yes.
So you left SA Water, again, I forget what year, 92 you were saying, and you founded Water Pumping Institute in 2003. You better tell me the numbers, I've forgotten.
Yeah, so Sandy and I started our own business in 2003. We were resident on the Gold Coast then. We did the whole sea change thing and moved from South Australia with a one-way ticket up to the Gold Coast, bought a house and started a business. And the business was really consulting in the water industry and the water pumping industry, essentially. So we named our company Telemenco Proprietary Limited, and Telemenco is derived from the Talabudgera Creek, which we lived right next to, Tally, and Menco is just kind of a nice ring to the end of it. And that was Sandy. She's very innovative like that. And of course, you know, I was determined not to use the word pump or water or irrigation in the company name, because you'd just become an also-ran. So it had to be unique. And it wasn't till many, many years later, in fact, only 2 years ago, that I was doing some work with a guy in the United States, and he said, you really ought to change your trading name. And he suggested, what about Water Pumping Institute? And I thought, yes, that's it. You know, because essentially what I'm doing is the work of an institute, which is a training organization out there. What's the pedigree? Well, the pedigree is 5 decades of real world experience, and hardly any institutes that you care to go to learn will have that sort of background. You know, most are academic, and that's the real difference. So we call ourselves an institute, but we're definitely not institutionalized, if you know, if you get the difference, you know. Mm. So it's got the perfect, really, it wraps up the intent of the business. And since using the word Water Pumping Institute, it's certainly raised a lot more awareness of what we do. Yeah.
But that moment to go out on your own?
2003, you're talking about, that when you started the business?
Yeah. What made you do that? It's a big step, working for yourself.
You know, you just, you have some ideas, and you know, you want to follow some ideals, I guess, and you just do it. And I think it's, procrastination is not part of my vocabulary. You know, I make a decision, I want to do something, I do it, you know, but I engineer it.
Mm. And so those first steps in terms of, you know, creating a business idea, deciding what you're going to do with that business in terms of essentially forming a training institute, how did that process take place? Is that over a period of time?
I think there's a definite trend here that this century has been the century of energy efficiency, and it's called, you know, essentially renewable energy, you know, the quest to lower our carbon footprint. And part and parcel of that has been an industry desire to improve the carbon footprint of pumping systems. And I think it really got underway when the federal government started handing out grants or subsidised energy audits for pumping systems. And I was invited by the abalone industry, which is, you know, across Australia, to do several audits on very large abalone farms. Having done that, I then started to do the same thing in the irrigation industry. And what I found was chronically bad pumping system design. And having come from SA Water, where everything was engineered so well, and then going out into the private sector, where most things were thrown together, kind of a shoot from the hip, by comparison, a shoot from the hip kind of attitude, I felt compelled to change a few things. And I had the wherewithal to do it, so I did it, and you know, the training course just developed from there. Yeah. It's been a labour of love, absolutely. I think I would have spent about 1,500 hours of time developing the PowerPoint presentations for the training course.
That's a lot of hours that's gone into it and refining.
And I'll vouch for that. He has put a lot of effort, and I love the way Rob, what's the word, presents it. Not so much presents as in verbal, I know he presents well verbally, but the way he presents it graphically. I really mm-hmm. took a lot of new ways of presenting difficult, complex matters. So thank you, Rob. That's a big plug. Big compliment there.
Thanks, Anthony. It gives me great pleasure to put a smile on a face like someone like yourself, who, you know, is a stalwart of the industry and critical, and yet I can still put a smile on your face. You know, that to me is gold.
No problems. I'd love to show you, Simon. This is the way, just the way these graphs is, and yeah, it's really good.
It certainly sounds intriguing. So have to have another conversation with you, Rob.
I want to ask another question to you, Rob. Your best friend, Sandy, your soulmate, your wife, you've mentioned her a couple of times. Please tell our listeners about how important she's been on this journey and her involvement in Water Pumping Institute, because I have a feeling Water Pumping Institute would not be around if it wasn't for her. So talk about this partnership you've got going.
Yeah, good. Thanks, Anthony. Sandy and I have been together since 1999. It's our second marriage. We met through an introductory agency. Okay. In those days, the old card systems, you know, it wasn't like the phone apps of today. We met, you know, for coffee, and it was kind of it was an instant thing. You know, we had a rapport there. We were both country people. She grew up in country SA, different part of the state than I did. But, we had somewhat of a religious background. So we spiritually, physically, we had a commonality and an attraction that was just evident, you know, in the first few minutes. And, by the time we'd finished coffee, I said, look, I've got to go to visit my mum, which is 100 kilometres away. Do you want to come for a drive? So she jumped in my car and came for the drive. You know, like, it was like we'd met 10 years ago. It was incredible. And this kind of togetherness has been with us the whole time. We rarely have to argue because we see things the same way. And that's an incredibly unique, position to be in, because most marriages fail when you can't agree on something and you just constantly argue. And when you're not in that situation, you can actually put your energy towards, you know, doing things that are more useful. And that's what we do, you know. We both working towards the same goals here. I mean, Sandy is not a techo like me, but she's had an enormous amount of experience in company administration. She's been a previous director of other companies. She's got some pretty good credentials that carry us through. You know, she's been right up through in the law courts fighting battles to protect her IP. So she's a damn good ally to have on my side, I can tell you. And we just continue getting on with it. And, it's
maybe she's the secret to your longevity, 76 years and still going strong. 25 years marriage this year, Rob. It sounds like an expensive one.
Anthony, I have to say that with a good relationship, the sum of the two components are greater.
Individual parts.
Sorry, than the individual. The sum of the two are greater than the individual parts. By streets.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
Yeah. So nice. We're a team. Yeah.
Right. So she's focused on the business, making sure that you've got things to go to, and you're the man who delivers.
I come up with a lot of ideas, and the first thing I do is bounce them off Sandy. And she said, yeah, that's a good idea. Or no, 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 don't go there, Robert. Don't go there. You know, and I don't quite have the sense that she does, because, you know, in a lot of ways, I'm too focused, whereas she's, you know, more encompassing. She's a good judge of character too. Sometimes we'll walk around, you know, in a conference, and I'll get talking to someone, and she'll give me a nudge. She said, you know, watch this fella. So, and in hindsight, she's been right. You know, incredible foresight she has. Yeah.
Mm.
Yep, she's been an amazing part of our team.
Congratulations again.
Yes, it's great synergy.
Yeah.
Simon.
Well, I'm thinking about all this experience and some of the reflections that we have, I guess, during these conversations, Rob, is the learnings. And of the learnings, what do you think you would tell the younger generation of engineers that is coming through? What would be some of the key things that you would share with them, aside from obviously energy efficiency and pumping and pipeline systems? Do you have any other pearls of wisdom that you would otherwise think to pass on?
I think the main one would be to constantly challenge everything that you learn. Now, to do that, of course, you've got to have a database as a benchmark. And you can only build it up, that database, in time with experience. And so, you know, I often think back to my career when I was 25 years old. I knew everything. And 50 years later, I think I'm now asking all the questions. Whereas back then I was providing the answers. You know, that's how life goes. You know, you get out of uni and you kind of know everything, and you know, you try to influence the world, and 3 or 4 decades later you realize how little you actually knew then and how little you still know, because I'm still learning. You know, at 76 I'm still learning an incredible amount.
That's a great attitude.
Yeah, that's right. Wisdom is certainly something that comes with age, and part of that is realizing how little you used to know. That's for
absolutely,
sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Simon. Yeah.
And I have to say, Rob, this is not aimed at your age, but, you know, using the apps, creating these apps that are distributed in the course and all this technology that, you know, 76, you know, you haven't grown up with it. You've created your own website. You've done all this stuff that I'm very, very admirable of this. I would have no idea how to create an app and a QR code that's linked to the app, and let alone a website like yours. So yeah, it just shows how much of a dedicated you are to continually improving, which is a big, big thing for me as well. So,
it's exactly the same, you know, attitude as building this, really. You have a vision, and you engineer it in your mind. And mind you, a lot of this is at 3 a.m. in the morning, as I described to my class, and Anthony would remember. Mm-hmm. A lot of my really, really valuable information comes to me at 3 o'clock in the morning. And sometimes I get up and write it on my phone. But that's just one of the natures of myself.
Where your inspiration comes from, I suppose.
To improve the way we do things, I think. That was born in me on the farm when I was a kid.
Mm.
It's part of me.
Mm.
And I don't assume anything's wrong, but I do challenge it, you know, and is there a better way? And often in that journey, I realize, well, hey, you know, what's the motive for doing it this way? And you realize, well, the motives maybe don't have quite the credibility that they should have. So, you know, the other really, really important part of my career is that I've never sold product. So I always say to people, I haven't blotted my copybook, you know, which is a saying that you've created a dark line in your life. Selling product takes the person away from reality into their own little world about their product. And the two are vastly different. I always, you know, refer to the anecdote when I was 16 years old and I went to boarding college. That was the same year that I built this dragster at home on the farm during the school holidays. And I had an uncle, Uncle Claude, and he lived only about 2 kilometres from the boarding college. And the first time I went to see him, he had a pretty new Peugeot motor vehicle in his driveway. And I was totally unfamiliar with this sort of vehicle. And I said, "What's good about this Peugeot, Uncle Claude?" And he said, "Oh, it's the best car in the world. It's the best car in the world. And all the, you know, it's made in France and blah, blah, blah." And I thought, "Oh, okay." You know, I was still impressionable, 16 years old. I'm just taking it all in, right? So the next time I go to visit Uncle Claude, it was about 2 months later, and the Peugeot's gone, and in the driveway was a brand new Ford Falcon. I said, "But," I said, "Uncle Claude, what's happened to the Peugeot?" And he said, "Oh, a heap of junk." I said, "What?" He said, "This car is the best car in the world now." Okay. So I realized right from very early age that, hey, you know, when you become a salesman, you put blinkers on. You don't realize it, but that's what happens.
Believing in your product, that conviction is important when you're in sales.
Absolutely. You have to be to sell. But when you're buying, you need to stand back and take stock.
Mm.
I've got a couple more questions, Simon. How are we going for time? What do you think?
Yeah, we're nearly at the Fabulous Five.
All right. I just want to ask maybe one, maybe two, Rob, if you can.
Yeah.
What are some of your next goals, challenges that you set for yourself? You're going strong. What next?
Okay. So I think it comes back to the relationship of work and health. And at the moment, we've got a really good balance. All right. So it's been my observation when people actually stop work, they kind of deteriorate very quickly. And at my age, I'd be very, very susceptible to that. So I hope that doesn't happen anytime soon. Ultimately, it will. There'll be something that will happen that will probably stop me from doing at least at the rate at which I'm doing or in the present format that I'm doing. But I aim to continue to teach the water industry what I know to be true as long as I'm able. And that will keep me young, 76 years young. Yeah. And there's a couple of other factors that go into that. One is diet and the other one's fitness. And I'll look after them both very tightly. Yeah.
Yeah, very important.
It's funny, Simon, when I was getting ready to catch up with Rob for his workshop, and, you know, he said 56 years of experience. And when I met him in real life before the course started, I'm looking at him and I think he's got his numbers wrong. What year would he have started at? 10 or something? He hardly looked 60 as he started at 4 years of age. I don't know what's going on. So whatever you're doing, Rob, your cycling, your swimming, your diet, your happy marriage is obviously working for you. I have one more question. You mentioned just before we started this interview, you had a profound moment that you wanted to share with us in your life. This has got my interest. What happened? Did you have a near-death experience or something?
No. So this was, it was in the years of my apprenticeship, and I was riding motorcycles. So I'm a bit of a petrol head, I guess you could say. This was
with
the
dragster.
This was in the era, the late 60s was the era of the muscle car. You may recall. And I was all over that, except I couldn't afford a muscle car, but I could afford a pretty damn good performing motorcycle, which I purchased with the help of my dad for street use, you know, to get around in. As an apprentice, I decided to modify this bike for racing, to take it road racing. So it was basically a road bike, but it wasn't a racing bike. It had all the credentials, a twin overhead camshaft, you know, for 1969, it was extremely good engineered. It was a Honda. So I converted that to a racetrack kind of with all the rear set footrests, and I did a lot of machining in the workshop as an apprentice because I had access to lathes and things. And I took it racing at Malala. Now, Malala was on the national circuit back in those days. That's been replaced by the Bend. You've probably heard of the Bend. So that's replaced Malala. Malala was a World War II airfield and it was converted after the war into a racetrack because it had a coning tower. It was perfectly situated for that. So a mate of mine and I hired this track twice on weekends before the October 1969 Australian Tourist Trophy meet, which was a motorcycle meet. And that meeting attracted a lot of interstate competition. So here was me pitting myself against the national, Australia's best on the racetrack. So the very first race I went in, there was 26 in the field. I was at the rear. It was a six-lap race. And at the end of that race, I was second. And at the end of the first lap, I went to sixth position. So I had a mate who was my mechanic. He said, watching you go down the main straight was like a picket fence. You know, I had a lot of these guys that were sort of going putt-putting along, and I was going on the outside of them on a bend, doing like 100 miles an hour, 160, you know, crank right over. I was fearless. You know, when you're 20, you're fearless.
Mm.
So the main race of the day, that was all the interstate competitors. And I got a much better start position then, but I still came out second place. So, you know, that to me was a defining really time of my life. When I realized if you apply yourself and engineer it, you can do a lot of things. You can go places. And I suppose that epitomized it. I took a long, long time to get over that. Just thinking about it used to raise my heartbeat. Just lying in the bed thinking about it. It was terribly difficult because racing gets in your blood and it's just so hard to get out. But I decided, no, I'm not going further than this because I've seen the demise of so many people who do, and that's all they live for. They don't have family life. There's a lot of things they don't have. I didn't want to go that way. So I've been there, done that.
Yeah, it's knowing when is the right time to call the day before it's too late.
Yes. Where do you go from there? You know, I'd achieve what I set out to achieve. You know, I had this drive to get out there and beat those blokes at their own game. So that's the t-shirt. It's got the picture of the bike. So about 4 months later, after that event, a guy came up to me on a bus on the way to work. He said, "You're Rob Wilkie, aren't you?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "I've got a photo of you on Malala Racetrack." "Have you?" And that's wow. It, you know.
That's fantastic.
That's the only one I've got of that day.
You sound like the Australian version of that fastest Indian with Anthony Hopkins. Yeah, that's who you are.
The fastest Indian in the West.
Yeah, no, the movie. The world's fastest Indian or something.
Yeah.
You ever seen that movie?
Yeah, the guy from New Zealand, Invercargill. I'll watch the movie. Don't worry.
I'll over it.
The same drive, Anthony. The same drive.
All right, Rob, we better get on to the Fab Five. Simon, did you want to kick us off?
Sure. What's been the greatest piece of advice received and who told you?
My father said, don't be part of the world. Do your own thing, essentially. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. Be afraid to swim against the stream.
Well, it creates challenges. But I mean, we grew up with challenges. You know, when you grow up on a farm, every day is a challenge, and you overcome it with using initiative, design, you know, engineering. It becomes a way of life. Yeah.
Lovely. Okay, my turn. Question two. Who would you like to share a dinner with and why?
I was going to say Queen Elizabeth. I reckon she's pretty cool, but she's passed now. I certainly wouldn't want King Charles. But
you're not the first person to say Queen Elizabeth, by the way. Yeah. You're a second person.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, a magnificent lady, you know, humble as you could get, and yet, you know, clever enough to run a country in essence. The quiet achiever. I think would sum it up. Yeah.
What an amazing run. What was it?
60 something years.
Yeah. Because I saw her in 1954. You know, as a 6-year-old, we came down from the farm. I came down in a brand new FJ Holden belonging to the neighbour. And we lined up in the Adelaide showgrounds. And we were there standing in the heat for, I don't know, hours. And then we got to see you for about 10 seconds. 1954. There you go. So I have seen her in the flesh. Yeah.
Okay. Question three. What is your greatest non-work related achievement?
I think the motorcycle racing at Malala, without a doubt, that's still in my mind. Indelibly. Yeah.
And for our listeners that can't see, Rob's wearing this black T-shirt with a photo of him on this motorbike. Honda 450, second place, SA. I don't even know, was it TT? What does that mean, TT?
Tourist Trophy.
Tourist Trophy, my apologies.
Yeah. You heard the Isle of Man TT? Well, this is the South Australian TT. That's the miniature version of it. How many of these have you got? Only one.
Yeah, how many shirts are those you got?
One, only one.
Anyone.
I don't believe you.
And I just I bring it out on special occasions because it's one of the defining moments of my life.
I'm gonna have a chat to Sandy. You probably got a whole wardrobe with those T-shirts. Okay. My question. Question four. Favorite place to travel and why?
Oh, well, I think New Zealand, South Island. Why? Probably because we don't have any snow here where I live, so it's good to be able to get to see the snow, tall mountains. We just love, you know, Sandy and I both feel the same. We just love the tall mountains. When you fly into Queenstown, it's the most amazing experience that you fly in between these huge range of mountains, you know, like about 8,000 feet high, or, you know, 3,000 meters. Just an incredible place. So.
Beautiful.
New Zealand, South Island. And we've been to a few. We've been to China, Japan, and the USA, and a few Pacific Islands. I haven't been beyond there. Love to go to Europe. If I can get a training course up in Europe, I'll go there.
Okay. Final question, Rob. Question five. What is your go-to drink, red, white, or other?
Well, it's other at the moment, Simon, because I've made life-changing decision to stop drinking alcohol, to preserve what I have left of my physical condition. So as of Christmas Day last year, I stopped drinking alcohol. I'm still doing amazingly well. Tell you what, when you travel and you feel, you go to a new place, you feel euphoria, the first thing you want to do is sit down at a bar and have a drink and sort of waft off into another land. You know, the last trip to New Zealand was the most challenging I've had in that respect, because I feel like I just want to drink. And I said, no, I've got to stop. I have to, I can't weaken. So before then it was a Pinot Grigio.
Yeah.
And what is it now though? Well, I'm hanging out for, what do you drink now?
Well, I haven't found a good alcohol-free wine, so I've gone back to kind of zero beer. Peroni's good, zero beer, and Heineken zero, Peroni zero. It's my favourite now. Sorry to disappoint you, folks.
No disappointment, no.
One day I'll have to come up with a non-alcoholic wine, Rob.
Oh, they're out there, Anthony. But
see, if I can make a non-alcoholic wine, I'm not sure I have that expertise to do that. I might need some help with that.
Yeah, I find they have too much sugar in them as a non-alcoholic wine. They're too high in sugar.
Well, you look great. You're doing a great job contributing so much to the industry. Thanks again, Rob. We really had a great time.
Thank you as well, Rob. That's quite interesting hearing your story. It's great to hear another man with passion and dedication. So, yeah, thanks for coming on.
Thank you, guys. It's been a pleasure to share some of my life's experiences.
Thanks again, listeners. That's another episode of the Good Drop Podcast. We'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.